Hey, this is Derek, and you're listening to Skepticality, the official audio program of Skeptic Magazine, for Tuesday, March 24th, 2015. Skepticality. Welcome back to another episode of Skepticality, the show that brings you news and interviews with authors, researchers, and people from all walks of life, the promotion of critical thought, skepticism, and science.
I'm Tim Farley of whatstheharm.net, skeptools.com, and virtualskeptics.com, and this is Skepticism Past and Future. This time we've got mass delusions and tools that disappear. One of the many interesting elements of human psychology that comes into play in skepticism is the phenomenon of mass delusions or collective delusions. There are many instances of such events that have been documented over hundreds of years. They are often attributed to paranormal or pseudoscientific causes when the true cause is within the human mind. As a result, various aspects of these events are studied by sociologists, social psychologists, and also psychiatrists. They've been seen to affect tightly knit groups of people who interact mostly with each other. These events are not just about a false belief spreading rapidly through a population. They can also result in reports of physical symptoms that seem to have no organic basis. When this occurs, it is called conversion disorder and is often triggered by some seeming threat, such as a strange odor. Symptoms can include trance-like states, spasms, shaking, headaches, and more. Here are a few such incidents that have occurred during the months of March and April over the years. A small earthquake struck London on February 8, 1761, followed by an aftershock that occurred on March 8, exactly 1 month later. This sparked a rumor that an even larger quake would destroy the city the next month. A large number of people evacuated to the countryside, some camping outdoors and others hiring temporary lodging. And of course, nothing happened. An extremely strange mass delusion hit Seattle in March and April of 1954, and it's known as the Seattle windshield pitting epidemic. After a newspaper reported some damaged car windshields in a nearby town on March 23, 1954, similar local reports ensued. The police received hundreds of calls about tiny pits on car windshields. Some attribute it to radioactive fallout from a recent Pacific test, a likely source of anxiety for the local residents. Investigations eventually showed that nothing more unusual than coal soot was on any of the windshields. In the Israeli-occupied West Bank in March and April of 1983, hundreds of residents reported fainting, headache, abdominal pain, and other symptoms after rumors of poison gas attacks spread through the population. On March 27th, over 60 residents were taken to hospital after witnessing smoke from a passing car with a faulty exhaust. Tests eventually showed no poison was involved, and the rumors and symptoms eventually subsided. In March of 1990, an outbreak of respiratory infections at a school in Kosovo rapidly escalated into another panic. It spread through an ethnic Albanian community who mistrusted the local Serbs and suspected they may have dispensed poison. The scare spread to dozens of schools and featured symptoms such as headaches, dizziness, chest pain, and more. There are many more cases that have been documented over the years, and there's a most excellent article covering these episodes and more from a 2000 issue of Skeptical Inquirer that is available online, and I will link to it in the show notes. Last week, I blogged at Skeptools about what to do when a favorite online tool disappears. This was sparked by the recent announcement by Facebook that the aging social media service FriendFeed, which they bought in 2009, would be shut down in April. I often recommend free online tools to skeptics on my blog and in this segment, and it can be jarring to have one of them suddenly disappear. But there are some strategies you can adopt to minimize the impact to you when this occurs, and indeed to minimize the chances that you will pick tools that are likely to disappear. One thing to watch out for are products that are minor elements of the product line for a larger company. That was the problem with FriendFeed once they got bought by Facebook. The key thing to remember here is to be aware of business developments affecting the services you use. Keep up with the news enough to know who bought who. So let's say you've chosen a tool that is the sole product of a company and therefore unlikely to be declared redundant. A problem to watch out for here are completely novel ideas that have no direct competitors. This is sometimes a clue that the concept of the site is not catching on and may be doomed to failure. A site called Truth Market, which I wrote about back in 2012, fell prey to this syndrome and was shut down. In the commercial arena, what will sometimes happen in those cases is a company will decide to pivot. They will completely change their product into a different category. A fact-checking site called TrueClick executed a pivot recently. Originally, they checked numerical claims in news articles, which could have been useful to skeptics. But they changed their focus to extracting and highlighting quotes about the news. Now, sometimes a pivot can be beneficial, as in the case of the product Is It True, which I recently covered on this segment. It was originally an expensive piece of commercial software, but the company pivoted to turn it into a free online service. That made it vastly more useful to skeptics. Outside the commercial arena, sometimes free online tools are created as a part of an academic research effort. This is true of many Wikipedia-oriented tools, such as Wikiscanner or Wikitrust. When the research project that spawned them comes to an end or loses funding, sometimes the tool will lose support as well. That can also happen if the tool is supported by a nonprofit organization. So do keep track of the funding of your favorite organizations. Two things I highly recommend here. One is to always be aware of viable alternatives to any online tool on which you rely. That way, if the one you are using disappears, you know right where to switch. The second is to choose, when all other considerations are equal, to use services that are built upon open source software. In those cases, if the original service were to disappear, you or others could launch an alternative using the provided open source computer code. I have more ideas and links about this topic in my blog post from last week. This brings us to the end of another edition of Skepticism Past and Future. Links to the sites I mentioned and additional materials are in the show notes at skepticality.com. And follow me on Twitter or Facebook under the name Krelnik, K-R-E-L-N-I-K, where I post a daily fact from Skepticism's past and ongoing news of Skepticism's future.
Hello and welcome to The Odds Must Be Crazy on Skepticality. Aspartame was discovered when chemist James M. Schlater licked his finger while working in a lab.
And the microwave was invented after a researcher walked by a radar tube and a chocolate bar melted in his pocket. I'm Wendy Hughes.
And I'm John Rayle. Wendy, you dated a lot when you were a teenager, right?
Yep, but that was such a long time ago, it might qualify for carbon dating.
How dare you.
Our coincidence story this week is about teenagers out in a car. Listener Craig in Australia writes, "Hi, I have this story that is totally legit. Happened to me a few months ago. Basically, one Sunday night, we heard a big crash out the front of our house. Turns out a car had crashed through our neighbor and my front fence with three young occupants, two males and one female. The police came and took the relevant details, and while getting names, we realized the driver lived right next door to my sister, who lives two suburbs away, Melbourne, Australia. She always said they were dodgy neighbors. When my neighbor's daughter-in-law came around to see if everything was fine, she realized that she knew the female occupant of the car, who then begged the daughter-in-law not to tell her parents. Her sister was the godmother of the girl in the car. So it was two coincidences in one crash. The odds must be crazy. Regards, Craig.
So it is a small world, after all.
Yep, even on different continents.
The Odds Must Be Crazy contributing editor Mark Gouch drives home the point with two familiar concepts, that most car accidents happen close to home, and the 6 degrees of separation. Mark's analysis begins with proximity. There's an old adage that says most car accidents happen close to home. We've all heard this, and it seems reasonable that since we drive to and from our homes quite often, that we probably spend a lot more time driving near our home than far away. So we would expect to have more accidents close to home. According to the Driving Today website, this kind of data is surprisingly not typically gathered by law enforcement or insurance companies. But the Progressive Insurance Company completed a survey in 2001 to try to find out. Gather a decent amount of data, analyze the data, and learn something. What a progressive thing to do. According to the site, they gathered information from people who were involved in 11,000 accidents and found 52% occurred within 5 miles of home and 77% within 15 miles. Isn't it nice when actual statistics confirm what we thought we already knew? This seems to not usually be the case. So much of what people think is true turns out not to be true when researched objectively. But that is another story. Craig said his sister lived two suburbs away. Suburbs is not a standard unit of distance in the U.S., so we are not sure how far that is. It's probably safe to assume the distance is 15 miles or less. If so, then the person driving had really good odds of having an accident within a radius that includes his house. So the fact that the driver lived only two towns away has to be considered as unremarkable, or actually pretty likely. It would be highly unlikely for a person who lives in Canada or Argentina to have crashed into your yard.
Next, Mark addressed the 6 degrees of separation.
I'm getting there. Mark continues. Okay, Craig, your neighbor's daughter-in-law knows one of the people in the car. So let's restate this. Not your neighbor, not his child, but the child's spouse knew someone in the car. So the acquaintance had 3 degrees of separation, so to speak. Halfway to Kevin Bacon. Not sure if your part of the world will get that reference. It seems that this coincidence should be calculated by the number of acquaintances that your neighbor's family has compared to the number of people living in the greater Melbourne area. The number of acquaintances that people have on average has been estimated by various methods to be in a wide range of between 150 and 300. A very cool teenage acquaintance I asked said 1,500 minimum in this, the social media age. But I think that is high. According to Robin Dunbar on the Social Science Space website, a good estimate is 150. In this case, we are talking about acquaintances of family members who will have some overlap in the people they know, so let's conservatively use 100. So if your neighbor knows 100 people, and each one of those 100 knows 100 people, then the total number of acquaintances of your neighbor and his acquaintances is 100 times 100, or 10,000. Assume your neighbors have two children, and both are married. So we have your neighbor and his wife, their two kids, and their two spouses for a total of 6 people. Those 6 people should have about 60,000 acquaintances. Wikipedia, the source of all knowledge, indicates that about 4.5 million people live in the greater Melbourne area. So it seems that the odds of this coincidence would be about 60,000 over 4,500,000, or about 1.33 out of 100. That's not all that low. If we use 150, the odds come out to 3.0 out of 100. So if we apply the same assumptions and calculations to the odds of you and your family extended to the same 3 degrees of separation, knowing someone in the car, the odds would be exactly the same. And for both of the coincidences to happen would be about 1.33 over 100 times 1.33 over 100, which comes to about 178 per million. That's low. But not really low. If you want to make the odds of this happening again higher, consider moving to a smaller city. And lastly, who the heck was that third person?
Thanks for listening to The Odds Must Be Crazy. Please be sure to stop by our website and involve yourself. Make a comment. Tell us if you think we got it wrong. Submit your own stories.
Special thanks to our new analyst team member, Mark Gouch. Thanks, buddy.
Our theme music comes to us courtesy of Mr. Deity himself, Brian Keith Dalton. You can find him at MrDeity.com.
And you can find me at YouTube.com/SkepticallyPwned, where false claims get kicked in the nuts.
Thanks again, everybody. So I was recently pointed to a very cool article that was published in the Orion magazine. It was called Defending Darwin. It's a great story about what it's like to be a working professor in Kentucky who has a passion for teaching evolution. The story gives a great insight into what it's like to fight to educate students about the reality of evolution and the proven science behind it. The professor who wrote the article is Jim Krupa. I was able to get in contact with him through the folks at Orion magazine so we could do an interview and chat about his work and some of his past struggles and why he has spent so much of his life promoting good science and actively promoting evolution, even in rather difficult situations. So today I'm sitting here, well, no, I'm not. I'm on the phone with Professor Jim Krupa. I assume that's exactly how it sounds.
Yep, you got it.
All right. And you're a professor at the University of Kentucky still?
Correct.
And you teach evolution?
I do teach evolution.
All right. Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And you won a lot of awards for your teaching, one of them from the National Association of Biology Teachers?
Yep, I got a couple from them. I got their Evolution Education Award, and the year before that I got one of their other awards, so they have been very good to me.
I was turned on to getting you on the show because you recently put out an article on Orion Magazine. It's called Defending Evolution.
Defending Darwin.
Yeah. When I did some research based on the things you said, you got your passion for teaching evolution after going to school, and you had a really good teacher who taught you evolution.
Yeah, I mean, I had a number of great teachers in college and in high school, which I've learned that the greatest teachers and the worst teachers are the ones that will most inspire, hopefully more good teachers. But I had absolutely great teachers. So I was at Omaha Central High School, and I always liked science. I wasn't a particularly good student, but the biology teacher there, the physics teacher there, the earth science anthropology teacher there were just passionate, and they were absolutely great, and they really got me all worked up about it. And by the time I left Central, I knew I was going to be a scientist when I grew up. But the person that really stood out among the three or four teachers there, and the thing that I still find fascinating, I was there for high school for 3 years, and I had, I think, about 6 years of science because it was just so much fun with their teaching. But the one person in particular was Creighton D. Steiner, at Earth Science with him. I think I had some biology with him, and I had anthropology, but he was just so passionate about teaching, and he was such a cool guy that I just couldn't help but getting enthusiastic about all this. And in his anthropology class, a huge hunk of it was human evolution. And he knew a lot about it at the time. And the thing that I thought was so funny is it was a great class, and I naively assumed everybody in the country can take a class on human evolution. I had no idea how rare that was that he did that class and really set himself apart from others. It was just amazing. So, yeah, it was one of these things where I want to be like him when I grow up. He was a pretty impressive guy. And the thing that was really interesting is that I left high school and I went off to be an undergraduate at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and then I got my master's there. And when I started my master's, he was finishing his master's degree with the same advisor, Jim Fawcett. So for a year, we overlapped as academic brothers. And I thought, how cool. Here's my idol. And now we are both getting our master's together. He was finished 2 years before I did. So even though he was still teaching high school, he was in the evenings and on the weekends, and we took a class together and went on field trips together, and that was just pretty incredible. And the thing about him that was so special, one of many things. He was from a little town called Genoa, Nebraska, about 100 miles west of Omaha. And this was an area that was just littered with Native American artifacts, broken pottery and chips of arrowheads and things. And so one of the things he would do a couple times a year is he would charter a great big school bus, and anybody who wanted to go out to Genoa to look for artifacts could go. And I went on a couple of those trips, and it was a lot of fun. And then for my anthropology project, I was supposed to go out during spring break in my senior year and look at a particular area for artifacts and pieces. And so I got on a bus, went out there. He set me up in a little hotel. So I'm just an 18-year-old, little hotel, and gave me his grandfather's old pickup truck and showed me the study site. And every day I went out and worked. In the evening, he'd take me to a bar for hamburgers and would play pool. how cool is this? I'm playing pool with my high school teacher, and he was also my neighbor for a while. So it's one of those things. He was just above and beyond anything he had to do as a teacher, and his enthusiasm was so infectious. I really don't know how anybody couldn't get cranked up about what he was teaching. So he's a pretty special guy.
Well, I found it fascinating about that part of the article when I read it. I had some of the same feeling when I was in high school with one of my biology teachers who taught human evolution as well. When I moved down here to the South, even when I was in college, I just assumed that everybody, I mean, I heard tales of people who didn't believe in evolution, but I just assume it was like such a small fraction of people because I didn't. And I was in southern New Jersey. So, you know, when I went to high school, I didn't meet anybody there that was like that. And I knew people that were everything from Quakers to, you know, Amish, and nobody had a problem with it. So it was, it wasn't until college where I started to meet people that were, you know, well, you know, it's just a theory. Well, do you know what science means when they say that? No, they didn't. And then I moved down here to the South where you run into people like, I work with somebody who has a PhD in geology who is a young earther.
Yes, unfortunately.
How does that happen? I don't know. So it's very strange to me that we still run into this. And and like you said, it's really about the teachers. And I think, so if you have a really good teacher who teaches you evolution the right way, I can't imagine that anybody would still have a problem with it.
Yep. Well, and the sad thing is, these poor teachers who would want to teach it or teach evolution with a stronger angle will get flack from parents. And I know a lot of teachers that will say that the hardest part of their job is getting grief from these parents that object to any form of enlightenment that is being shared with their students. So it would be more widespread if parents didn't try to shape how topics were taught to students. But the thing that's interesting is we think of this as being a southern U.S. issue, but every state in the U.S. has had some level of anti-evolution activity other than Hawaii in about the last 5 years. And even though we don't hear about it much, it might be a rural school district, who knows what, but it's hard to imagine that, it's actually everywhere in the U.S. It's just, I think in some states it's more covert. It's certainly not as bad in some areas. It's more of a rural issue than an urban issue, but it's lurking everywhere. And there are more and more nations worldwide that are having more and more anti-evolution groups being more active. And it's disturbing that as the evidence for evolution grows by leaps and bounds, the resistance to it in some ways is increasing. And I think that's because the more the evidence is there, the more those who fear it will fear it. So we've got a long way to go. It's a big battle.
I was reading that you even said that you ended up in Kentucky to become a professor?
Yeah, I mean, academics is a hard world. I graduated from the University of Oklahoma, was applying for academic positions all around the country, had an opportunity to come here as a postdoctoral researcher for a few years, and then I applied for the tenure track job here. But, you know, it's not that I by any means said I want to end up at Kentucky. I kind of wanted to end up in Montana or Oregon, but jobs are hard. And even this job, when I applied, there were 600 other applicants. So in academics, I think think we're all thankful if we can get a job anywhere. And so for me, it happened to be Kentucky.
Now, you mentioned that at first, when you were offered the job, you were actually kind of reluctant to do it because the requirement of teaching biology to non-biology majors.
Yeah, and so, yeah, the job was very specific that it would be teaching non-majors introductory biology to big groups, so 300 students. I've had as many as 500 students in one class. And so we all know that the hardest teaching gig in science is an introductory non-major science class, and even more so if it's in a big setting. So it was one of those things where, you know, I needed a job for sure, but this is the most daunting teaching environment anybody could enter into, and I didn't have a lot of teaching experience, so it was scary. It was just downright scary. So I was definitely reluctant about it because I just didn't know if I could do it or not.
And when you said that was E.O. Wilson who had some thoughts that he wrote down that really convinced you that maybe I should give it a try?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I have it right here on my shelf somewhere. It was when his autobiography, Naturalist, was published. I remember I was listening in the morning. I was listening to NPR, and Bob Edwards was interviewing him because the book came out, and that's when the conversation struck up that he felt these introductory classes are the most important classes, and especially at Harvard, where many of the nation's leaders are taking classes, that this is the class has to be taught. This is the class that has to be taught well, and it's sort of this doing it for the greater good. And since E.O. Wilson is such an amazing person, I thought, well, if this is what E.O. thinks, then maybe I better give it some really serious thought about why this job's important. And so he did manage to sway me.
Well, you know, I mean, as it's been said many times, it's one of those things that there's no real biology without evolution.
Nope. Everything in biology makes sense only in the light of evolution.
Yeah. Now, what really depressed me is, after I read your article defending Darwin, the second comment on the article was by an intelligent design promoter, an idea that was completely, thoroughly debunked by many different angles, and we still have those arguments popping up.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I haven't looked at many of the comments. Part of it is I would get frustrated.
Oh, so, yeah, I'm about to say, it's an exercise in frustration many times.
Yeah, and so that is what's hideous. I mean, the Kitzmiller versus Board of Education, or now the Dover trial in Pennsylvania, made it very clear that this is not science. This is just repackaging creationism. There's nothing new here. That's it. The word has come down, and yet these folks are still talking the talk, trying to make it sound like science. And it really is very frustrating that that you can give somebody all the evidence in the world and they choose to ignore it. And I was told about that ID comment on the Orion site, and that, oh well, I can't even. I used to debate these folks, but I'm not going to spend time debating them online. It's pointless, because that person's mind is made, and in some ways it would enlighten some of the folks that would read it. But I think I'd basically say read the decision from the Kitzmiller versus Board of Education decision and leave it at that. So, yeah, very frustrating.
Oh, yeah. And well, at least most of the people who commented afterwards were pretty much on your side. So
yeah, it's good.
I think they took that problem out for you. So.
Yeah, good for them. Well, I also got quite a few emails, and most all of them were quite good. Every one of them had some good positive comment, but then I had one from a geologist here at this university that wanted to quibble about me saying the story of human evolution is the greatest story, and he said that, well, maybe it is the greatest science story, but we Christians have a pretty good story as well. And we're talking about science. It's my opinion that I think it's the greatest story, but I thought, wow, we're quibbling about something like that. And then it goes back to that comment. So we have We have a geologist that has interesting views that I don't think most geologists have. So I found that a little disappointing.
It's amazing to me because I've run across many PhD level geologists who are on young Earth creationist type people.
And I don't understand that. And there are plenty of those kind of folks associated with the Creation Museum, and I just simply don't understand that. How can you possibly look at geology and come up with anything else, plus all the evidence, and dismissing radiometric dating and the whole bit to stick to this view? But that's the nature of humans. We do like to believe what we want to believe. Otherwise, we would be doing something about climate change and the dismissal of vaccinations.
I know. We've talked about all those issues on this show for the same, Rob, same reason.
Well, and we have to keep talking about them. And you know, I think that's the one good thing with this measles outbreak out west, which has already fizzled out of the news limelight, that when people see the problem, maybe they'll wake up and realize whoever's saying vaccinations are bad was wrong, and we need to do something about it. So sometimes it takes bad things maybe to wake people up. And then the other thing is, like we're doing right now, is to keep talking about it, and maybe somebody will listen and take note.
So as a professor, you must have come across this one of the coolest stories I've read in a long time about evolution, the story about the London Underground mosquito.
Let's see, which one is that again?
The mosquito that was trapped, not really trapped, but because people went underground during World War II in London, and these certain mosquitoes have now created their own species because they can't breed with the other above ground mosquitoes anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. I vaguely remember that, but I'm not crisp on that. That's the fun thing about this area. I'm constantly learning about new examples. I'm going to have to look up that article and read it, but it doesn't surprise me that it does not take long for evolution to happen in certain situations.
Well, especially when you have something like a mosquito who dies like within like a week.
Yeah, well, and especially things like mosquitoes, where the shorter the generation time, the faster they can evolve. So that doesn't surprise me. Nothing of this sort surprises me, but that is actually a really good example. I need to refresh myself. It's kind of in the back of my mind that I heard about that.
Yeah, when I read that, it's like, oh, that's like one of the best arguments, because one of the biggest arguments I always hear is we have no example of this actually happening. Well, we do now.
We have plenty of them. Well, the thing that I always find fun is that when you get that argument, and I say, well, we do have examples of pocket gophers in the process of evolving right now, where we physically can't tell them apart, but molecularly we can. We've seen mouth parts evolve on various butterflies in the Hawaiian Islands, where bananas have only been in the Hawaiian Islands for, 400 years? These butterflies have been there forever, and yet there are butterflies native to the Hawaiian Islands that have now evolved mouth parts for eating bananas. So there you go, and then I'll get the counter, well, you didn't actually see it happen. and I say, so basically you're telling me there's no evidence for evolution unless humans can live for tens of thousands of years to watch it happen. And it's such a frustrating argument. And I've heard all these fun little counter arguments to that sort of thing, where they will say, well, you can only determine if evolution exists if you watch it directly. And I said, well, we do see it directly on so many different levels. But then I'll counter it and I'll say, so what you're telling me is nobody can be convicted of murder unless the jury directly witnessed the murder. And they'll say, well, that's silly. But that's your argument. And I used to go to talks given by creationists around here just to listen to their arguments. And there was this a brilliant young student that was there, and he was using this same argument about the jury directly witnessing the murder. And the student held up his hand and said to the creationist, so do you feel that there's evidence that I have a hand? And the creationist said, well, of course, I can see your hand. And then the student put a book in front of his hand and said, by your reasoning, you no longer have any evidence that I have a hand. That's just too good. I'm going to have to use that.
I like the other one was, did you think your parents had sex? Because you didn't see that.
Yes. Yeah, that's good. So, you know, it's these amazing things that the arguments that they come up with are really pretty ridiculous, and it's because there aren't real arguments. So if you don't have a good argument or a real argument, you have to come up with others that are pretty silly. And I think part of our job is then to point out how silly they are.
Yeah, and I find it embarrassing that here in the United States, one of the richest countries in the world, we're just under Turkey as the least educated about evolution in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very sad.
Yeah, the 34 richest countries were the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
How's this happen?
That statistic haunts me.
Yeah.
And then the question is, how are we going to change it? Well, that's going to be tough when we have a little over half the politicians in Washington, D.C. Telling us there's no evidence for climate change. If the policymakers do not want to accept evidence, how can we expect the general public to accept evidence? So at what level do we start this education? It's just tough.
Well, my big problem with that, too, is that back when I was in high school, the ozone hole problem popped up.
Yeah,
and we've solved that, and it was a big issue, just like climate change. There, all the politicians, they all jumped on board. There was no giant conspiracy about it. And what happened? Where suddenly now it's a big thing, and we had just as much evidence then, and everybody jumped on board, and they fixed the problem.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing to think about, because to me, the big three, rejection of science and evolution, rejection of climate change, rejection of vaccinations, and each one of those has a little bit different reason. Evolution, it's a threat to one's religious beliefs. Climate change, we can't see it. It's happening so slowly. The fear that there will be economic repercussions if we try to change it. So that's a little bit different. And then the whole vaccination thing, I don't even know. That's just stupidity. But I think part of the issue is try to figure out the fiber that connects all of those together. And then why is it that we're having trouble with that fiber and that connection versus the ozone thing not being a problem? I think part of it is the ozone issue was taking out those various gases that we were producing for substitution. So in some ways, I think that was a less painful solution, and that made it easier. If we could see, it would convince people to see that climate change wasn't as bad of a solution or a change that we think it is, and then maybe things will move along. But yeah, it's the ozone example is a great example of when everybody accepted science. So how do we make ozone response to the norm for reacting to things? I don't know. It keeps me up at night, needless to say.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned the whole thing about religion rejecting evolution, even though 77% of all American Christians belong to denominations that supports evolution. So I don't understand how that happens.
Well, but you know, it's interesting. So, because Roman Catholics are officially okay with it, I wish that meant that the Roman Catholic Church. I wish that meant every Roman Catholic did. But you know, I know plenty of Catholics who insist that the Church's stand is against evolution. And in that case, what it tells me is there are so many people who do not understand the details of their denominations and their religious beliefs. You know, for a Catholic student to come up to me and say the Pope never said what I claim the Pope said is so ridiculous, because the information is there. So I mean, so the Lutheran Church is accepting of evolution, and yet they're flat earth Lutheran groups. There's one in Missouri. So hard to believe that the Lutheran Church is officially okay with evolution, and yet they have some members who still think the earth is flat.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Can we win when we still these days have people who still believe the earth is flat?
It's tough. Yeah. So the first thing, convince all flat earthers they're wrong. And then next step, convince all geocentricists that they're wrong. Maybe we chip away. I mean, those are very small groups. But just the thought that I've heard various stats. I don't know how reliable they are. I think they are that almost 20% of folks in North America think the sun orbits the earth. I mean, I've never met any of these people knowingly, but supposedly somebody claims they're out there.
Yeah.
So how can we get anywhere if we have that going on? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever met somebody who believes that either, but trust me, after doing this show for pretty much 10 years now, I believe that somebody out there probably does. Because I've heard crazy stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to have an in-depth conversation with such a person unless they're open to other comments. But I don't even know how to converse with somebody like that if I ever encounter them.
Now, you mentioned that you've had a lot of fun, I call them fun, interactions with students, and you talked about a few of them. Mm-hmm. Some of them really kind of surprises me about some of the students getting vocal in the back of the classrooms and storming out.
Oh, it shocks me too. But the thing is, it's very unusual. So, of 24,000 students that I've had, I have probably had fewer than a dozen that stomp out and slam the door. But that 12 is quite a few. And you know, I'm shocked every time it happens. I think when the student shouted out that Darwin denounced evolution on his deathbed, I fortunately I'd heard that before.
Yeah.
So unfortunately I had a fairly quick recovery, but I was stunned when that was said, and I was amazed at how angry that student was. It's unbelievable. Fortunately, it's only a few times. Most of it really comes down to my teaching evaluations, and I have pages and pages and pages of written comments complaining about the evolution and teaching of it and how wrong it is. So it's mostly in that way. But yeah, to have a student come down and ask me if I've ever read the Bible or I know what the Bible is, or tell me that I must be an atheist if I teach evolution, or slam the door, as seldom as it happened, just happening is just unbelievable to me.
You teach in Kentucky. I imagine you get a lot of students from Kentucky that came from...
University of Kentucky has... Well, I don't know what the percent is in state. It's predominantly in state. I get a mix, but I've certainly had anti-evolution students from out of state. I'm not sure exactly where they've come from, but I mean, there's the Creation Research Institute in California. So I think Californians like to think all this is a Southeast United States issue, but they forget that the Discovery Institute, the folks that promote intelligent design, they're in Washington. They're creationist organizations in California. So I'm sure that I've had creationist or anti-evolution students from the western states as well.
Well, you in Kentucky, don't you have like the ARC camp thing that's being built?
Well, we have the Creation Museum, which is pretty embarrassing, and they do want to develop the ARC Park, is also pretty embarrassing. Well, they don't call it, I forget what they call it. We call it the ARC Park, but it's certainly embarrassing that we have to have this stuff in this state. And part of it is other states like Tennessee didn't want to have anything to do with it. we're just hoping that the ARC Park never comes to be. I think they're having some financial troubles with that. They're certainly having financial troubles. So it would be an embarrassment, and it's a lot of land that would get leveled for this. So, yeah, it's not anything to be proud of.
Well, yeah, I think most of the problems they're running into is trying to get public funding for something that's for a government to support that is pretty much against the separation clause.
Yep, and they were threatening to sue the state. I don't know that they actually did. It seems like I would have heard if they did, but yeah, they keep threatening, and yet when it's very clear that they will not hire somebody unless they're Christian, and then think that they're still entitled to state tax exemptions is just absolutely stunning to me. I have a number of friends here that so wish that they don't want the ARC Park to happen, but if it did, they want to go underground, or not underground, but they want to take on an alien and see if they can get a job there. I think that would be very interesting. They're going to have to do some lying to get through.
Yeah, I've dealt with people who have tried to do this in the past, and it goes really badly because they really have pretty much figured out the best way to weed out those who are actually not believers and they're crazy.
Yeah, well, and I was amazed at how good they are at that. So the Creation Museum, I assume, still has some sort of a newsletter online thing. I don't pay much attention to it, but we had a graduate student here several years ago that he decided he'd write a seemingly pro-creationist, seemingly scientific article to submit to get published. And I looked at a couple drafts of it. So he wanted to look silly, but not so silly that the folks at the Creation Museum would toss it out. And I thought, well, give it a try. Why not? But I said, you really need an alias. And he goes, no, I'm going to do it with my name, absolutely my name. So he sent it with his name. And they had determined that he was in biology, therefore probably a problem, and that they went into his background and sent him a fairly rude letter or email saying there's no way they were going to take this, and berated him a little bit. So yeah, they were definitely ready for that. And I think if he used an alias, they probably would have sniffed it out anyway, as you say.
I'm pretty sure that, especially because of the lawsuits and things, they have pretty keen to make sure that nobody sneaks in.
Yeah, and they must be getting people threatened. They're trying to do that routinely.
Yeah. Trust me. I've talked to so many people who mentioned the same thing, that they would love to do it. So.
Okay, yeah. So it's a little problem they're creating.
Yeah. A lot of your passion is about trying to correct some of the teachers who have been trying to teach evolution, but you mentioned that many of them teach evolution incorrectly?
In my opinion, and it's always my opinion, but the journal, The American Biology Teacher, over the years had several editorials pointing out that the big mistake was that evolution was being taught as a separate unit near the end of the semester, when if it's the unifying theory of biology, you don't do the unifying theory at the end as a separate unit. It should be up front at the beginning, and it should be a fiber that runs through the semester. And when I read a couple of those editorials, this just makes absolute sense. And I certainly never did it as a unit at the end, but I realized that I really needed to get it to flow through the semester even more than I did. So that is the argument. If biology is based on evolution, why isn't it at the beginning and significant as the foundation? It's sort of like with a scientific method. Would we talk about defining theory and hypothesis and the scientific method in the last few days of the semester? Well, I suppose some people do, but teaching the students how to think scientifically should be up at the beginning, and then the foundation of biology should be up at the beginning. So, yeah, there are certainly those that are not particularly strong on it, and unfortunately, we've got a few of them at this university, and it's simply a mistake, in my view.
Yeah. And then I've also heard that you have some strong commentary on how Dawkins tries to teach people.
Well, I had an interview the other day where Dawkins will come up all the time.
Yeah.
And I like to point out that, you know, the guy really shaped my life as a biologist. I was a young grad student when I read Selfish Genes and then the Extended Phenotype, and he so made it evolution clear to me. And so he's one of the new age atheists. Some people refer to him as the angry atheists, and that's fine. But the problem is, I wish the leaders of the modern atheist movement weren't also evolutionary biologists, because their atheistic views are really separate from their scientific views, but the public's not going to see it that way. So everybody's well aware of Dawkins. I'll have students bring that up all the time. Well, but you're telling us that you don't have to be an atheist to accept evolution, but Dawkins is an atheist and he's an evolutionary biologist, so there you're wrong. I'd say, no, that's not the case. President Jimmy Carter is one of the big defenders of evolution, and he's evangelical. So Dawkins' religious views are his religious views. They're not necessarily linked, or don't need to be linked, to his scientific views. And then I give him those kind of examples. So yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah.
That they have to be linked.
Well, you could even, like, tell them things about, how about Francis Collins?
Yeah, and I do. Francis Collins comes up. I have a long list of evangelical Christians who are defenders of evolution that I make sure I throw out there. There's a person named Michael Dowd who used to be a Baptist minister.
Yeah.
And, he's had several books, and I do point that out, that he is, yes, he is one of the defenders, and he is not an atheist in any way, shape, or form.
No, he has the Thank God for Evolution book.
Yeah, that's what I was looking. It's right here on my shelf. I have a number of his books, and I've heard him speak a couple of times, so that line is not black and white or a dichotomy, as we like to be told. There are people of every denomination, every religious belief, accepting of evolution. They're not all atheists, but yeah, that makes the argument easier.
Yeah, like you said before, it's like, well, the Pope believes in it, so
yeah.
I don't think he's gonna have tea with Dawkins anytime soon.
No, what I think is very interesting is somebody once pointed out to me that Catholics will say that they're Catholics, Methodists will say they're Methodists, Presbyterians will say they're Presbyterians, Baptists will say they're Christian, and someone said they don't do it all the time. I go, well, a lot of the time, and I've been in a couple of talks. Well, I was actually at one of Michael Dowd's talks at the Unitarian Church here in town, and a person was sitting right in front of me. She said, well, okay, that might be how Catholics think, but what do Christians think? And I just couldn't believe it. I wanted to interrupt and say Catholics are Christian, but it's one of these weird things that you get this bizarre dichotomy. And I'm almost losing my point here because that's got me worked up. But you know, it's one of these things that if we don't want to accept other Christian denominations, how are we going to accept science? You know, it's this level of intolerance, but it's just I don't remember how Dowd responded to that. Now it's been a long time, but it's very, very interesting to hear these kind of views. How can you possibly have this view? So the point is that every type of belief system is represented by people who do accept evolution. We just have to keep remembering that and keep pointing that out.
Well, like you mentioned before, it's funny because it wasn't until actually kind of recently in America where the different denominations of Christianity would call themselves Christian. They all referred themselves as their denomination. So
yeah,
it wasn't until actually quite recently that they all now go under the umbrella of Christian. Before then, it was, I'm a Baptist, I'm a Methodist,
yeah.
And so that thing, that internal battle between the different faiths was common until recently.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'd like to see when that timeline came about. The point that I was making, because I remember it was going to be a good story, that I do listen to, and I don't do it much anymore, but I would listen to creationists when they're in town. And we actually have a person here who's a full professor who is a New Earth creationist who would go out and give talks. And I'd usually sit in the audience. And we actually had a debate, ACLU-sponsored debate many years ago. But this particular person, actually, I heard him in a talk say that Catholics weren't Christian. And I thought, uh-huh, interesting. So I'm going to keep that in my mind. And when we were on stage for the ACLU debate, I think it was late 90s, I can't quite remember, I just kept thinking of the great debate between Thomas Henry Huxley and Bishop Wilberforce, where Bishop Wilberforce at some point said to Huxley to the effect, so which side on your family is the ape, your mother's or your fathers? And supposedly we'll never remember, know for sure because it wasn't written down, but Huxley leaned back and I think he said to his friend Hooker, he goes, he has been delivered unto me, or something like that. And while I'm sitting up there during the debate, I kept thinking, I wonder if I can get my opponent, I'm so tempted to use his name, but I can't. I wonder if I get my opponent to say publicly that Christians or Catholics aren't Christian. And I thought, even better, ask him to explain how it is possible that then Pope John Paul, who's still alive, could be accepting of evolution. And so I asked him the question, how is it that the Pope accepts evolution? And just sat there waiting to see if he'd take the bait. Would he say, because he's not Christian? But it was actually even better than that. So the person said, well, I think the reason is I probably had a more solid Christian upbringing than the Pope.
Really?
Yeah, he said that, and there were a couple hundred people in the audience, and I kind of leaned back in my chair, and I said to myself, he has been delivered unto me. and a couple of Catholic theologians in the audience just went berserk. So it wasn't supposed to be open dialogue with the audience. It was supposed to be write your question down on a piece of paper, hand it forward. But there were a couple individuals that were up on their feet, absolutely laying into this person about what a ridiculous thing to say. And I thought, okay, that's about as good as I can ask for, short of what I was wanting him to say. But it was such a hideous comment. I couldn't believe it. But I think he knew I was trying to set him up to tell us that the Pope wasn't a Christian.
That one baffles me.
Yeah.
I can't even think how anybody could make that leap.
Yeah.
I can't figure that out.
I think I had him twisted around enough. He really didn't know how to respond to that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was so fun because as he was just getting pounded by the audience, I got to take a little break and just kind of lean back in my chair. And I was contemplating how cool it would have been to watch Huxley and Wilberforce go at it when Huxley clearly had by far the upper hand.
a shout back to the monkey trial.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, Clarence Darrow going toe-to-toe with William Jennings Bryan.
Yeah. And so, you know, and, you know, you're in Kentucky, so, you know, you should do that all the time.
Yeah.
Go figure. So let's let people know where they can find some of the cool stuff you have, that full essay. It's at Orion Magazine?
That's correct.
And then there's... go ahead.
March-April issue.
And then you have some audio from the Orion. I guess they have a podcast, too, where they did an interview with you on the same article.
Yeah, yes, that's correct. And apparently, I haven't seen it, but the National Center for Science Education has a little piece called Teacher Thursday that I think I did the interview with the folks there. And that came out, and I think you can go to their website and find it. So there was a conversation there from last week that was a lot of fun.
They're good friends of this show. Actually, I've used to hang out with their president all the time, who recently retired, Eugenie Scott.
Yes, Eugenie Scott.
Yes.
And what's interesting about Eugenie is she was a faculty member here at the University of Kentucky and left here to head on out to greater things.
Yes, so. I know. She and Massimo Pelucci actually were students there at the same time.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And both people I admire greatly.
Yes, I love Eugenie. She's one of my favorite people.
Yep, it was hard shoes to fill with her retiring, but those folks out there are all outstanding, and they'll do great.
Yeah. So, well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and let people know where they can find maybe your personal information, if they can maybe, if you do any speaking lectures that aren't, you know, you have to pay to get your class.
Yeah. I think I don't know how that works. I suppose they can wander in as long as the room doesn't overflow. But some people have commented how annoying it is that I'm trying to maintain myself as a nature boy. So I don't have a cell phone. I don't blog. I don't even have a website, which my university keeps pointing out I really should. So I get a lot of annoying comments that I'm trying to stay under the radar. And I think I probably should at some point go ahead and do it. I keep telling people the more time I spend doing that, the less time I'm actually observing nature. But I'm going to have to probably get a couple centuries forward and catch up to the current one. So they can always email me, and if they have questions, and they can go to the University of Kentucky website, and there's a directory there, and they punch in my name, my email will pop up, and I'll be glad to interact with them.
Well, great. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and hopefully I will maybe meet you in person someday.
Yeah, that'd be good. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to chat with you as well.
I have to thank Jim once again for taking the time out of his active teaching schedule to come on the show.
I should also thank the folks at Orion Magazine for helping me work out his schedule so he could do this interview. And along with that information, there will be links to many other things you heard here on this episode over at www.skepticality.com.